Hello and welcome once again to the Many Rules of Film Club. This is Jeff Yance, the program director with the Loft Cinema, and please welcome Heather Lattis, occasional filmmaker.
Hi, Jeff.
And Rusty Boulay Stevenson, multimedia artist.
No more wire hangers!
No, oh, yes. Well, again, good lead-in, Rusty, because today we are talking about... So we all have families, or have had families at some point, or will have families in the future. So we're going to talk about dysfunctional family movies. With the holidays coming up, it seems like it's about the right time to talk about this. So this is a very popular genre in Hollywood. I think Hollywood knows that, again, we all have families, have had families, or will have families. So it's something everyone can relate to. So each generation gets its own dysfunctional family classic, and I think we all have some of our favorites. But maybe to just talk a little bit about why we want to talk about dysfunctional families. What is our history? What is our dysfunctional family history?
Well, my family, we get along super well, my parents and I, but I don't remember when it happened or how. I moved out to Arizona from Indiana, and my parents on Thanksgiving made it a tradition of coming out to Arizona. It's a much nicer time to be here than in Indiana, November. And so they would come and we'd have Thanksgiving at my house, you know, and I was watching artsy movies and stuff, you know, and I would inevitably want them to watch something. And it was always this dysfunctional family movie. So it kind of became my, at some point I recognized it after 2 or 3 years. I'm like, oh, well, this is my tradition. Is I show my parents dysfunctional family movies. And it's great. And so we watched Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson.
Sure.
Who, you know, he's the black sheep and his family's all these high society folks, and he goes back after his father's had a stroke to be with the family, and dysfunction occurs. I showed him The Sweet Hereafter 1 year, which is a really great film.
Yeah.
And the dysfunction in that film, the family dysfunction, it happens and you see it, but it's so glossed over almost. It's not like the main part of the film. Though it's intricate to the storyline, it's not a main part of the film, and it's really interesting how the dysfunction in that movie is shown.
Right.
And then 1 year I took them, I guess 1999, I took them to the theater on Thanksgiving to see Magnolia.
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah, it was great.
Yes.
Great dysfunctional family stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've carried it on since then. We've watched lots of stuff. My parents don't come out for Thanksgiving, but we do it now with my family, you know. Maybe this year I'll show my son Max Dugan Returns.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's kind of a...
Was it the Elliot Gould film?
I think so, yeah. When Matthew Broderick's in it. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Jason Robards.
Yeah. And
carry on the Magnolia tradition.
Yeah. And with, you know, with the holidays coming up, I mean, that does certainly lend itself to the genre.
Yes.
Holidays are about families getting together, stirring up old resentments, hopefully creating new ones so that you can stir them up the next year.
Yeah.
Because I think very rarely do you see happy family movies, movies about happy families.
Well, they're not terribly interesting.
I would not want to watch that film.
Yeah.
No.
The happy family, that's just going to make me mad, and you know, it's not going to be a good movie.
And that's pretty dysfunctional.
Yeah.
To get mad seeing other people's happiness. But I think filmmakers have responded to this whole phenomenon by creating a lot of great dysfunctional family films. So, Rusty, since you seem very steeped in the dysfunctional family cinema genre, how about your fave?
Okay, well, I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's one that feels like I wanted to talk about it. It's a documentary from 2012. It's called The Queen of Versailles. You can find it on Netflix now. It's about a family, David Siegel and his wife, Jackie, and their 7 children and 1 adopted daughter. And they are very wealthy. David is... He calls himself the timeshare king. He sells timeshare and he owns this huge timeshare company called Westgate. And the movie follows them as the reason it's called Queen of Versailles is because they are building what they say is the largest family household in the United States. They call it Versailles because they went to Paris. And they saw Versailles, and she's like, so I want to have my own Versailles.
Of course.
That's rational.
And, you know, that's rational. And, of course, the way they come up with the architecture for this Versailles is they're in Vegas and they see the Paris Hotel
yes.
and they just base their Versailles on the top three floors, the exterior of the, but just to give you a sense of how big this house is that they're building, the movie came out in 2012. It's 2016. The house is not finished. And in fact, during the movie, it looks like they won't even be able to, but they've since made their money back. There was the collapse of 2008 and they no longer gave him cheap money, as he says.
Right. Right.
But this house is constructed on a man-made hill on 10 acres of lakefront property. It will include 11 kitchens, 14 bedrooms, 32 bathrooms, a 30-car garage, a two-lane bowling alley, an indoor roller rink, three indoor pools. I've never been to a hotel that has three indoor pools. Two outdoor pools, a video arcade, a ballroom with 500 to 1,000-person capacity, a two-story movie theater with a balcony inspired by the Paris Opera House, a fitness center with a 10,000-foot square foot spa, yoga studios, a 20,000 bottle wine cellar, an exotic fish aquarium, two tennis courts, a baseball diamond, a formal outdoor garden. And this is the one that gets me, and you see it in the movie too when she starts talking about this is my closet, an elevator in the master bedroom closet.
Crazy.
So she's got a two-story closet. Wow. Does Jackie Siegel. The movie follows them and their fortunes as they rise and then diminish. You see them at the beginning of the film. She's a very smart person. You see, they show you her that she went to school for engineering. Hmm. She's obviously a very smart woman. She was in an abusive relationship. She got out of the abusive relationship. She became Mrs. Florida. And that's how she met David Siegel, as he's part of a lot of beauty pageants. This real estate mogul who's involved in beauty pageants. At any rate, so he's selling timeshares, and they show you the his son from his early marriage is his manager of his timeshare in Las Vegas, and his father and he have no relationship at all aside from the business relationship. It's really sad. You see the son always trying to do the right thing for his dad, and the dad just really not giving a shit. And that's how he is with even his small children. He has seven children with Jackie, and I think the oldest is 15. One has since passed away via drug overdose. Oh. But they had seven children, and you see him with their kids. He doesn't have any interaction with his children. It's really just all about business with him. And then you see what happens in 2008. They've been making these deals for timeshares with people, pushing them into this lifestyle. That's what they're selling. They're selling a lifestyle that you can't really afford.
Right.
But here, if you come and join this timeshare, then you'll get to live like a king when you're on vacation.
Aspirational living. Very
and
American.
A very American mm-hmm. thing. And that's part of why I picked this as my dysfunctional family movie, is because that's kind of what we as a family, as Americans, we all want to live above and beyond our means. You see sure. it all the time. I mean, that's why it takes so long to pay for my gas at the convenience stores, because everybody's got their lottery tickets that they're buying. And so that dysfunction and the dysfunction of selling these timeshares to people who really can't afford it.
Yeah.
And doing it, they would then wrap these deals the same way they wrapped up the home property sales before 2008 and sold them as securities then, and made these very risky deals and made it seem like it wasn't risky at all. And people invested tons of money in these securities, and the bubble burst in 2008, and it does for the Siegels. And you see them go through, you know, a downfall of sorts. And that's when you really see the dysfunction of the family too. There's so much of it that's so sad.
Yes.
You see her go shopping for Christmas. Jackie goes shopping for, she's like, well, we don't have much money now. I've got to go to Walmart to do my shopping. And she gets like six shopping carts.
She buys all Walmart.
She buys like the whole Walmart. And the way she talks to one time, because they did have a private jet the Walmart scene, let me just finish. The Walmart scene, I guess, is one of the saddest to me, because you just see her buying indiscriminately with no sense of what she's really giving to her kids. And right. In fact, when you see them open their gifts, one of them's like, oh, I got another Yahtzee set. You know, I got the exact same present twice. And it's just because she was so indiscriminately buying.
Right.
It's really sad, and it's a sad commentary on America, too, that we do that. That's coming. Thanksgiving's not that far off as we're recording Black this Friday. Right now.
Yep.
And Black Friday is going to happen, and people are going to go and buy indiscriminately stuff that the people they give it to won't care about. And that's how these kids were. And it was really sad, and it's a really sad commentary on the family and on the dysfunction of American life at times. You know, this real estate mogul who's got these pretty bad relationships. At one point, he tells his wife, she's like, he always said he was going to wait until I was 40. He's 30 years older than her. He was going to wait until I turned 40, and then he'd trade me in for 2 20-year-olds. And then at one point, he says, I'm just going to trade you in for 3 20s.
Oh.
And it's so hard. And then you see her dysfunction, just like the kids, like I was about to say, they have a private jet. They lose that. They lose their housekeepers, but they fly commercial. And as they're walking off the plane, there are all these people in the terminal, and she turns to her kid. She knows people are looking at her. There's a camera around her. There are all these people in the terminal, and she's like, so what was it like flying commercial, kids? Yeah. And just the way she talks to him, it's so gross, and it's so sad. And it's my dysfunctional family. I don't know that you should watch it for Thanksgiving, honestly.
This, I don't know.
You could. I think it would deter you from going to Black Friday.
Yeah. But it is a sad movie, but it's also funny. Yes. I mean, it's played to play well to an audience.
It does. It's very watchable.
There's a whole subplot, which is sad but funny, with the housekeeper, who I believe is she from South America?
I don't know. Or Thailand.
Maybe Thailand. But she is so horrified by the excess of this family that she chooses to live in the yard in a dollhouse.
Yes, I know.
Which is, she would prefer that to living in this grand Versailles that they're building. And she just wants to go home. She's raising money to go be with her family, whom she genuinely loves, but she can't afford it.
Yeah.
And it's this great counterpoint to this kind of over-the-top, crazy, rich family that has no sense of family whatsoever. And the maid's living in the dollhouse.
Yeah.
And dying to see her children.
And she has more sense of family than they ever will, sadly enough.
Yeah.
They seem to have a much closer relationship with the nannies than they do with the mom. And at one point, David Siegel even says, you know, she just kept wanting to have things, so she was having babies just the same way she would. They have a bunch of Pomeranian dogs, the white Pomeranians, and it's a mess. And if they didn't have it, they lose the housekeepers, in fact. And you see what happens when they have all these animals they can't take care of and all these kids that don't get enough attention as it is. And it really is a tough movie to watch, but it also, there are funny moments for sure. And you're bound to laugh. I mean, at one point she's like, well, I thought all this bailout money that was the government was giving out was going to go to common people like us.
Right. You're like, honey, you're not common.
You are not common. You are a lot of things, lady, but common ain't it.
And it's an interesting movie because you're alternating between being somewhat sympathetic towards her, Jackie, because she's obviously a smart person who got caught up in this American ideal of success and acquisition and buying and having things. But she's also totally clueless at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you don't feel sympathy for her because she's not great to her children.
No.
No.
But I think she's a relatable character to people because I think a lot of people get caught up in that whole system. Maybe not to that extent.
Right.
Yeah. No, people do. People do. I'm probably, I see some of myself, I'm sure, at times, you know. And like Heather, you pointed out, she would be a hoarder if she wasn't wealthy. We would call her a hoarder.
Oh,
and
totally.
If she didn't have the people caring for stuff, she would be a hoarder. Right. And you see it. There's dog crap all over the house once they lose their housekeepers.
Yeah, the garage is filled with bikes and toys. Yeah.
Bikes. That's the thing. After the Walmart, you see them unload everything from Walmart and go through the garage. She bought bicycles at Walmart. There are 30 or 40 bicycles in the garage that they walk past, and the housekeeper like hangs her head. And it's a sad commentary. It is really worth watching, though, just to think about what happened with the real estate bubble, to think about what it is we do in this consumer culture, and maybe find a little more grounding from it.
Yeah, and where family really fits into that, and the importance of family in the midst of all of that excess.
Yes.
It's always, you know, about your family.
And that's lost on the Seagulls.
Yeah.
That's entirely lost on them. You know, he kept saying, oh, they've quit giving me all that cheap money now, you know. And so he's always trying to find ways. He's scheming and conniving and trying to find ways to get back on top and just completely ignoring his kids. I mean, for Thanksgiving, he can barely be bothered to come out of his room where he's working. You know, he wants nothing to do with his family. He gets contemptuous of his wife. It's amazing they're still together. They sued the filmmakers twice after it came out because they didn't like their portrayal.
Yes.
I don't know how they thought it was going to go.
Well, they obviously were living in a bubble and they were thinking
that's the delusion.
You know,
they're obviously both very deluded.
Yeah.
Yeah. Know? And surrounded by sycophants and yes people. Right.
Sure.
And so.
Mm-hmm.
So this movie does not just be their sycophant, though. This movie shows it kind of bare bones and laid out that, you know, here they've got all this stuff and they don't have what matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a real fascinating movie. And it is a good holiday movie because I think it does tell you what's important.
Yeah. No, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Hopefully it does show that to people.
Yeah. And so, Heather, since the characters in this movie are... And Queen of Versailles are flirting with disaster.
Yes.
In a lot of ways.
That is very true.
Maybe that leads us into your pick for favorite family dysfunction film.
I picked a lighthearted, odd ensemble cast movie for dysfunctional families. It is Flirting with Disaster, directed by David O. Russell. It has Ben Stiller and Patricia Arquette are a couple, Mel and Nancy. And they had a son recently. And the beginning of the movie is definitely they're, you know, suffering from new baby. Where are we as a couple? We don't have time for each other, that kind of thing. And Ben Stiller's character is adopted and he decides that like he can't pick a name for their son. It's the baby's 4 months old. 4 months old. That's crazy. And he decides finding his birth parents will help him pick a name, will help him complete his life, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And so his adoptive parents are Mary Tyler Moore and George Segal. And it's hilarious. They're hilarious. And they're very helicopter overbearing parents. And when they find out that he wants to look for his birth parents, they're so offended. But he's determined to do it. He has Tay Leone, who is an adoption counselor / I think filmmaker. She's trying to do this study on adoptive children, meaning their birth parents.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And so Tay Leone goes along with them for the ride. And so she says, oh, I found your mother. And she's in, I think San Diego is the first place they go. And so they all go on this trip, fly over. And before they go, though, Mary Tyler Moore is like losing it. She's like totally freaked out that her son wants to meet his parents, birth parents. She thinks that they'll replace them, you know, that kind of thing. And Mary Tyler Moore plays this over-the-top, shrill mom.
She's great in it.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so they go meet the first woman who is his adoptive mother, who he thinks, and she's very Southern. She's from the South, but lives in California. And as they're going about, you can see Tay Leone's character and Ben Stiller's getting closer. Like they're flirting, they're, you know, there's a weird chemistry to them. And Patricia Arquette is just trying to raise her kid and figure out what's wrong with her marriage. And so they meet this supposed adoptive mother, and she's very Southern. And, you know, she talks about her Confederate ancestors. And she...
Also tall and blonde.
Tall and blonde.
Tall and blonde.
And she's even like cooing with the baby and calling him a cracker. And
just, a little cracker.
I was like, no. And then he sees his potential sisters, and they're tall and Aryan like as well. And then more things happen, and they realize she's not his mother. And so they're both like shocked, and you know, they realize, okay, she knows. She does some more research with the adoption agency and thinks she finds the father. And so they go on another road trip to somewhere in the cold Midwest. And I think it's Michigan. And when they go there, they meet someone who they say is father, who is very short, arrogant, and violent. They have this violent altercation when they first meet him before he knows or he thinks it's his son. And after this whole thing happens, he thinks it's his son. He's a truck driver. And he wants to be taught, Ben Stiller's character wants to learn how to drive the truck. And he ends up backing the truck into a mail station, a very small mail post office. And they get called, the ATF gets called on them. I'm not sure how that, I mean, I guess, I don't know if they deal with mail, but in this scenario, they do. And the ATF agents are Richard Jenkins, played by Richard Jenkins, and Josh Brolin. And it ends up, Josh Brolin knew Patricia Arquette's character earlier on. So that now it becomes two jealous situations. It has Ta Leone and Ben Stiller, and then Patricia Arquette and Josh Brolin. And then it just goes on from there. And then you find out that Josh Brolin and Richard Jenkins are a couple. And so they've got that underlying thing. And so it's all very, if you've seen any David O. Russell movie, they do the, he does the ensemble cast, and it's got different relationships and how people interact and respond to each other. And this is definitely one of his beginning movies to do that. It was like 1996 movie. So it's got some hijinks going on. They realize that the guy that was driving the truck is not his father. He was the guy who turned him into the adoption agency because his parents were indisposed. And he doesn't know what that means. So they get further information. They find out his real parents are in New Mexico. So he goes to New Mexico, and they are Lily Tomlin and Alan Alda, who couldn't be a better, like, comedic.
Who wouldn't want them for your parents also?
Right.
I mean, they're better. Like, they're so hilarious. And they play that typical hippie, older hippie kind of role really well. And, you know, David Russell went on to use Lily Tomlin in other movies
and yell at her.
And yell at her. That's a second point.
It's another story.
And Richard Jenkins and Josh Brolin is so hilarious together because they're very Richard Jenkins reserved character. He doesn't want to be out to the public, and Josh Brolin wants to talk about their sex life and their, you know. And so anyway, so they go and meet his new parent, his real parents, and they are drug making artists who live in New Mexico, and they have another son, and it becomes very just funny comedic scenes when the son wants to drug Ben Stiller's character, but he accidentally drugs Richard Jenkins' character, and they find out he's an ATF agent, and so they flip out, and Josh Brolin is still trying to romance Patricia Arquette. I mean, there's one scene that I have to mention that is forever ingrained in my mind whenever I think of Josh Brolin, and that's him licking Patricia Arquette's armpit. And it's very,
oh my God,
it's a very strange scene. But anyways, it's entertaining. It's
not erotic either, I should point out.
Yeah, it's not in a sexual
way. It sounds
way.
Pretty sexy, but it's not.
It's not.
Anti-erotic, no. In fact.
Some people find armpits attractive. I'm not one of them, but it's still, but it's all very interesting. They, you know.
When she's not turned on by it.
No, and she's just wanting to sort of get back at her husband, Mel Ben Stiller, for flirting and kissing. He does end up making out with Ta Leone's character a few times, and she's just kind of a mess. Ta Leone's like, I'm getting a divorce. I don't know what I'm doing with my life. And so anyways, in the end, you know, it all ends lovely. I won't tell the end little hijinks that happens, but it's funny. I don't think it would have been as funny if we didn't have Lily Tomlin, Mary Tyler Moore.
Right.
And George Segal. And
Lily
and,
Tomlin's amazing in it. Her whole body language. I love it.
She's trying. Anyways, she's great. She's just so, she does that role so well. And I wouldn't have laughed as much if they didn't have these older actors. So I think, like, they're underrated, and more movies need to have older actors, especially older comedic actors.
Yeah.
When older female actors, you see older male actors, you don't see.
Yeah, I mean,
it was refreshing to see Lily Tomlin, and
It's great, and it makes me think of the Netflix series, the Frankie and
Grace.
Great series.
Yes.
And Lily Tomlin again is great there. So I recommend watching Flirting with Disaster. It's a nice, fun, lighthearted, dysfunctional family, but there's comedic scenes, and it all wraps up to, it all comes down to what is normal in your family, which is if you would just communicate better and sit down and talk with one another, these things might not happen.
Yeah, and I think it was a pretty early movie that was looking at the idea of non-traditional families.
Yes.
That's right.
Because it's very supportive and progressive in that sense, which is interesting.
They talk about adopting the, you know, there's little quiet commentaries about that.
Yeah. And David O. Russell's previous film, I just wanted to mention, Spanking the Monkey, if you've seen that, which is also an extreme dysfunctional family film.
Yeah, yeah.
About a boy and his mother who are very close. Very, very close.
Mm. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Very, very close.
So this is a little less edgy than that, probably.
Yeah. And it's fun. It's like, you know, it wasn't like hard to watch at all. You know, it's a good watch. I think
it's lighthearted. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It really kicks in. The ATF agents, you're right, Heather. It kicks into gear once they join the road trip.
Yeah, it would have been boring had they not joined. The ensemble truly made this movie.
Yeah. And kind of a precursor to Ben Stiller's Meet the Parents in a way in terms of the plot.
Sure.
Although I like this because he kind of underplays it.
Very
in this
much.
One. Usually he's very over the top and he's very underplayed.
You can tell there's moments. I wonder if David O. Russell was like, reel it back.
Back, Stiller. Let's go back.
But it was good.
It reminds me a little of a Woody Allen film with Ben Stiller as the Woody Allen character.
Yeah, he's definitely neurotic and like very particular about things.
Yeah. Well, and I think Mary Tyler Moore is such an interesting casting choice because, you know, she was kind of America's sweetheart. And she's in one of my favorite dysfunctional family films. I just wanted to mention briefly was Ordinary People.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
Which I almost feel like Flirting with Disaster is referencing a little bit.
Probably.
And she played a very dysfunctional mother in that film.
Oh, she does. Yeah. That's one I should show my parents.
You should. Yes, do it. Do it.
I haven't done that yet.
She's so good. I mean, I don't know how she is health-wise, but I wish more people would put her in movies. She's so good.
I guess kind of coming to a darker note, but also hilarious in my mind, is one of my favorite dysfunctional family movies. It's not Ordinary People, although that is one of them. But what I wanted to talk about was the 1998 film Happiness, directed by Todd Solondz.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite directors, but it's also difficult to tell people that Todd Solondz is one of your favorite directors because you either get raised eyebrows or a blank face or someone turns away from you and just walks away immediately.
I would never.
So he's known as a real provocateur, I guess you could call him. Typically, I think, specifically seeks out topics that are going to alienate audiences, whether it's abortion or very extreme race relations, as we saw in Storytelling. His new film, Wiener Dog, which came out this year, which is about a very cute dog and very bad things happening around it and to it. But Happiness, I think, is the definitive Todd Solondz comedy, and I call it a comedy. It's a dysfunctional family comedy about three sisters, Trish, Helen, and Joy. They're all adults. They don't always act like adults, but they are adults. They don't really like each other. It's also a little bit Chekhovian. I think it's a little bit based on the Chekhov three sisters. So they each have their own trials and travails. Helen is a famous novelist, but she's not happy, but she has sex with a different man every night, but she can't find happiness. They're all searching for happiness is the theme. Joy is the sort of inappropriately named younger sister because she's very unhappy. She's a fledgling songwriter, but she's terrible at it. She can't sing. She can't really write songs. She works at an immigration education center. She ends up in a horrible relationship with one of her students who ends up tricking her to try and get a green card out of her. Horrible. And then Trish is the quote unquote the happiest of the three sisters, who is a suburban mom with three kids and a perfect husband.
He's perfect.
The perfect. Her perfect husband turns out, of course, if you've seen the film, he turns out to be a pedophile, which is one thing that I think the thing that made this film so controversial. And it's a real dividing line for people, whether can I even watch this film? Is it funny? Because the dad is a pedophile, as it's revealed in the film. But he's also portrayed somewhat sympathetically as a good husband and a good father. But he has this horrible issue in his life. And that's something that Todd Solondz does. He's very complicated. He doesn't necessarily show the character as a monster, which I think really upset people. Mm-hmm. Although he does get his comeuppance in the film. I mean, he is arrested, and But I think this is what makes him a fascinating filmmaker, and I think this is what art does, is that it kind of pushes those buttons and makes you question your morality and what you expect a film to do and what topics can be addressed in a film. And it's interesting that this film, Todd Solondz's first film, Welcome to the Dollhouse, which I also love, was at Sundance. This film was his next film. Sundance rejected it, said, this is too much. They wouldn't even, and Sundance is known for showing boundary pushing films, but this was too much for them. Universal Studios produced this film. When they saw the film, it won the International Jury Prize at Cannes. It was kind of a big thing. They saw the film and they said, oh no, no. So they dropped the film. It got an NC-17 rating. They ended up releasing it. Another producer ended up releasing it unrated. It was a real hot potato. And there's a lot of other, like Philip Seymour Hoffman is in this film and is amazing. He's a phone pervert who likes to call women and give them kind of ridiculously obscene voice messages until he ends up calling Helen, one of the sisters who ends up enjoying the obscene phone call and decides that she wants to meet this guy and then he can't handle it.
He's so gross. You don't want to meet him.
Yeah. But Philip Seymour Hoffman is so great because you still sort of feel for him.
Yeah, I feel bad for him.
He's also not portrayed as a monster, which is kind of the theme in the film, that everyone is broken and not necessarily a good person, but they're still humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can kind of still relate to him. He ends up dating another woman in his apartment complex. Who it's revealed has killed her doorman and chopped up his genitals and put them into her freezer.
Yeah.
But they still find love and they dance to Air Supply music and it's very sweet. But this is, to me, a great dysfunctional family film because the family does come together at the end of the film for Thanksgiving dinner. Mm-hmm. For one of the, I think, the craziest, most over-the-top sort of endings to a family film, denouncements, where the young son finally learns to ejaculate and then comes and tells his family at the dinner table. Well, you'll have to see it play out, but it's kind of an amazing film.
It is. It'll stick with you.
Oh, it's very memorable.
You don't forget the film.
No.
You do not forget this film. But it is a tough recommendation, I would say.
Well, it's worth, I mean, his ability, Todd Solondz's ability to make characters more than one dimension and to give them humanity for better or for worse. Like, you know, making the worst human being seem like a human and you maybe feel a little bit bad for him is an amazing skill. So in and of that, it's a good film to watch.
Right.
How he directs them and writes and all of that stuff.
Yeah. And as a viewer, that puts you in a very uncomfortable position if you're made to sympathize with a horrible person.
Yes.
And you almost are angry with the filmmaker for putting you in that position, I think, which I think he welcomes. And he obviously
loves that, feeling. He's yes, they're mad at me.
Yeah.
I love it. Which, I mean, hey, if the whole purpose of making a movie, besides fulfilling your own ideas, but to make people have an emotion, you know, you'll take anger too. So
A reaction is how I always feel. Like I was telling you guys, even if people are laughing out of awkwardness or because of the awkwardness of somebody on something I made, I like that still.
Yeah,
I like that still. They might think that it's not good or that it's not great because that's why they're laughing kind of nervously or whatever. But just getting a response, that's what you're looking for as somebody who's making stuff.
Right, exactly. And if you, I think not, again, I think I mentioned this when we were talking about Magnolia a while back, just not necessarily playing to the audience.
Yeah.
Like doing what you feel is right for you. And if the audience follows you, that's great. If they don't, that's fine. But Todd Solondz has always managed to get funding, which I find interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because his films don't make money and they alienate audiences.
They make you feel awkward.
Yeah, they make you feel awkward.
Make you yell at the screen.
You question whether you want to see another Todd Solondz movie.
That's right. Yeah. And he seems like a very nice guy. I don't know.
Interesting.
I don't know if this is all sort of fantasy fabrication or if it's based on anything from his real life. I knew he grew up in New Jersey where he sets a lot of his films and the suburbs of New Jersey. He has a very fertile imagination. If he had a happy childhood, then this is all fabrication and that's amazing. But I feel like there might be a little darkness there. Who knows? Yeah. I don't know. He's an artist. Yeah. But I would recommend Happiness as a dysfunctional family film with the qualification that you need to be very open-minded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very open-minded.
Yes. Yeah.
I watched a couple others for this podcast. I watched a documentary called Brother's Keeper. I don't know if you guys have seen Brother's Keeper.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
About four men, one of whom is accused of killing the other. They all live together, these brothers, in upstate New York, and they're accused of, one is accused of killing the other. It's a great documentary, really worth watching.
Right. Yeah.
Dysfunctional family at its best. I also watched You Can Count on Me with Mark Ruffalo.
Oh, and Laura Linney.
Yeah. That's oh, my amazing. Gosh, is that film amazing. I don't know that I've seen a movie that broke my heart in quite the same way sometimes. Mm-hmm. Is it Rory Culkin?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is in it as he plays an 8-year-old boy being raised by his single mom. And that there are things, the situations that he's put in. I have an 8-year-old son right now, and it breaks my heart to see what happens to him in the film at times. And it's a beautiful film, and it will break your heart, and it's wonderful. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend You Can Count on Me.
Yeah. And I would also just mention on the Laura Linney tip, Squid and the Whale.
Oh, that's a great one.
Which I think is an amazing dysfunctional family film. Laura Linney, Jeff Daniels, Jesse Eisenberg plays the son. It's a Noah Baumbach film.
Yeah, that's right.
Really kind of beautiful and real. Laura Linney has this ability to feel very familiar. Like, I feel like I know her.
Mm-hmm. Even I can see that.
Don't. Yeah, but she's very kind of relatable and approachable, I feel like. Which is why I think she's great at being cast in these very tricky roles. In Squid and the Whale, she's not a likable character. She's not a great mother necessarily. But you still feel for her.
Yeah. No, you do. You do. No, she's great. She's great in both those films.
Yeah. And I think that's the key to a good dysfunctional family film. You need to still be able to relate to the characters, even if they're horrible, even if they're squabbling. You need to be able to relate to them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the case. Even with the one I picked, Queen of Versailles, I still think you can relate to these people, even though they live in a way that I'll never live like that. And gosh, I hope I would never treat people the way they treat people. Especially my family, but there are moments where you do understand them, and You Can Count on Me as well. That's very relatable. That's very relatable. And part of it is, you know, you just, like with the 8-year-old boy and the way he's treated, some of it's just not following through for kids. Kids need you to follow through. And when you see it depicted that way, for me, it hit home, you know, like, oh gosh, I hope I do the right things. And it's a sweet, great movie. And so, yeah, dysfunctional family. Learn more about yourself.
Yeah. And yet I still love a good Thanksgiving dinner scene, SmackDown scene, where you're throwing biscuits and yelling and storming out the room.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Home for the holidays.
That's right. That's right. It's all part of it. So that's great. So go check out some dysfunctional family films. These are just a few. So thanks, Rusty and Heather.
Thanks,
oh, sure.
Jeff.
For that walk through dysfunction. So I want to thank Rusty and Heather for taking us down this road to dysfunction today. So I wanted to remind everyone to please check us out on iTunes and Facebook, and check out our website, themanyrulesoffilmclub.com. Send us your suggestions. And next time on Many Rules of Film Club, we're going to be looking at the holidays. Christmas is coming up. And so that leads me to rule number 1012 of the Many Rules of Film Club, is that it may be the most wonderful time of the year, but sometimes films show you the other side of that. So what we're going to do is look at some of the more offbeat Christmas films, some of our faves.
Yeah, yep. It'll be fun.
It'll be fun. So see you next time on the Many Rules of Film Club.